Our next case this morning is case number 56889, Mann versus City of Henderson. Andrew Jones and Vinny Dorsey for the land and that's established for the City of Henderson. Mr. Jones, and just Savage, before you get started, we have a group from UNLV, future paralegals. Some of you looking for jobs probably after they graduate. So keep that in mind. Margaret Picard is the instructor who's with them. She's a lawyer here in Clark County. And what I allow you to do is tell the audience a little bit about the case. It can take like a minute and a half, 2 minutes at most, to say what the case is about. And then you can start a reading on that. Google for the Savage second.
Would you like to start, Ron?
Yes, just tell me what it's about.
Good morning, everyone. Again, my name is Randall Jones. I'm with my partner, Jennifer Dorsey. And actually, my clients are here as well in the back of the courtroom. Longtime residents of Las Vegas. They have bought the property during the boom years, not so much probably anymore. And they bought a piece of property on the outlying part of the city of Henderson before it was being developed. So outside of any development, and then they waited like a lot of people do, they waited for the development to get up close to them. When it did, when it got close enough in the mid-2000s, they went to the city to ask that the property be zoned to allow it to start construction and build houses. We got into a dispute with the city over zoning initially, and then we determined that, in fact, the way that the city had actually mapped the area, they had not provided for any roads to go into the property. And ultimately, the city reached agreement with another property owner for some land that circles the property and all the accessible sides, put it into a public park essentially, and had a conservation easement, which means you could never put a road through it. And so now my client's property is essentially landlocked, and so we could file a claim for inverse condemnation to say that the city should compensate my clients for the property that they own that they cannot do anything.
Thank you, Mr. Savage. What about the city of Henderson, this man?
Well, the city of Henderson basically doesn't have any ownership interest in the property. Basically, the claim that inverse condemnation has been brought against the city, saying that somehow the city took away a property right this landowner had. From the city's perspective, this piece of land, and I think you'll hear the point of defense, this piece of property was landlocked and it was purchased by the plaintiff. And the plaintiff had owned the property by its allegations in the complaint for 5 years before this open space was accepted through a deed by the city. And during that moment in time, no access to the land had been arranged by the plaintiff, and it's the city's position that absent such a property right, this plaintiff doesn't have a legitimate claim for inverse condemnation against the city, because if there's no property right to take, then nothing has been taken.
And this case was dismissed in the district court?
Yes. It was what happened is the plaintiff filed a complaint, and the city moved to dismiss, saying that the complaint didn't state a claim for relief in reverse condemnation. And the trial court judge granted the motion to dismiss. The city appealed despite the plaintiff on having the motion to dismiss granted.
Thank you to both of you for doing that. Mr. Jones, ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor, if it may please the court, I have, and I've talked to Ms. Savage about this, and I think she has no objection. Hopefully help orient the court to the property. I have a couple of exhibits that I would like to present to the court, if I may approach your position. Your Honor, there are three exhibits. The first one is an aerial photograph of the property and the surrounding land in 2007. The second document is actually a...
If we have paralegals up here, they take care of us.
And as I was just mentioning briefly, the first one's an aerial photograph from the fixed the property and surrounding area in 2007. The second one is a map from the city. The only alteration that was made was to show the site of the actual property at issue on the map. And then the final one, and that shows the property in 2003 according to the city's land use designations. And then the final one is a city map that shows the property later on, I believe in 2007, again the same date as the aerial photograph. And I will hopefully point out the distinction between the maps and the significance of the various maps as I proceed. So I'm ready when you all are. Go ahead. Thank you, Justice Sherry. For the record, my name is Randall Jones, and I represent LandW LLC, the appellant in this matter. Your Honors, we're here this morning to ask this court whether it is fair and equitable, whether it is the public policy of the state of Nevada, under the cases such as McCarran versus Sisolak, State versus Las Vegas Building Materials, Penn Central, Lucas versus South Carolina Postal Commission, and other Nevada and United States Supreme Court case, constitutional case precedent, if it is appropriate for a city government to effectuate the taking of all beneficial use of property through mistakes, incompetence, violations of their own ordinances that results in the taking of all beneficial use of that property without any compensation whatsoever and to convert that property into what is in effect a public park. So that's what is really happening here today. And the reason I say whether or not that is fair and equitable, I would refer to, and by the way, I'd like to make a quick comment about something Ms. Savage said, whether or not this property was landlocked. When my client purchased the property, my clients purchased the property back in 2000, it was certainly not landlocked. It was no more landlocked. And then, in fact, if you would look at the map, the second map, which is the one that is from 2003, that demonstrates a couple of things that I think are important. As Ms. Savage said, my client bought this property in year 2000. And as typical of most landowners, remember, we all been here a long time. Las Vegas is the type of metropolitan area where there is lots of land that is on the outskirts of town, the outlying property. There are no roads. There is no infrastructure whatsoever to that land for years. So what the developer typically does, they'll buy that outlying property at a relatively modest price, and they wait for the infrastructure to get to them. And then once it gets to them, then it becomes practical to try to start to develop it. They can't bring in the infrastructure, especially those smaller landowners like this property. But if you look at this map from 2003, you'll see this is about 3 years after my client bought the property. The significance of this map, if you look at the project site, the square here, 10 acres, it's virtually square. You'll see it's in a sea of green, if you will. And if you look over to the right side, you'll see the legend that says, that is, designates that as public, semi-public space. So what happened is, for a period of years, through a mistake made by the city, which my client was not aware of until it went to try to zone the property more than a year later, the city had inadvertently designated this property as open space. All that green area was an area that another property owner, Rich McDonald, had owned, that he was ultimately deciding and negotiating with the city to try to convey to the city for a substantial tax benefit. In the meantime, the property on the west side was bought by Gare Horton, and you can see from the aerial photograph, it was built up. So during this time period, the homeowners that lived in the Hubbard property on the west, they look at maps from the city that designated my client's property as open space. So when my client finally, and the development has now reached a point where it makes it practical for my client to start to develop, what ends up happening is my client goes into the city planning department and says, we want to get put in a zoning application or a tentative map. And the city planner says, you can't do that. This is open space. What are you talking about? We own this property. We've owned it for years. That's when the mistake is discovered. Now the city has a very serious problem because all those homeowners, they think they have a right to that property. That's our property, City of Henderson.
you told us when we bought our house, that was open space. Now my clients are in the lumber. They have now taken on a political fight they had no responsibility for. And what has happened in the meantime, Your Honor, is the city has gone and entered into a conservation easement with all the other green property around it. If you look at the last map, that will show you the dilemma that my client faced. The last map shows my property is now surrounded on three sides by the open space that has a conservation easement. There is an opening, supposedly, on the east side. That has been determined today to be absolutely impractical. On the limited record we have, and I would remind the court we're here on the 12B5 motion, so there was no opportunity to create a record here to determine under Penn Central and some of the other cases that this court has relied upon, whether or not we have any basis, evidentiary basis, for an argument that our access was denied. So now my client cannot get access to the property. And to say it was landlocked, it was no more landlocked than if you look at the second diagram, the one that was from 2003, you'll see some yellow property that is just to the left of this the project site. That yellow property became the next D.R. Horton development. That property, as you can see from the city's own map, had no roadways into it. It had no roadways into it. So the city had to agree to provide access to that property with D.R. Horton. That otherwise, it didn't have an easement. That gets me to the next issue. I want to just say something that I think is very important here. This court has said repeatedly, and I think it's worth quoting, McCarran versus Sisolak, Justice Hardesty in his opinion said, quote, the first right established in Nevada's Constitution, Declaration of Rights, is the protection of a landowner's inalienable rights to acquire, possess, and protect private property. He went on to say, quote, our state enjoys a rich history of protecting private property owners against government taking. Now, with that backdrop, the city has essentially relied upon, and always unclear on the record from the district court, the Slope versus Turner case, where we believe that is absolutely distinguishable. And the case precedent that the city is asking me to create here would be an absolute aberration and essentially gut the holding that this court has repeatedly made over the years about protecting private property owners' rights. In Slope, if you look at it, and by the way, that property was bought in 1963, in the North Las Vegas area, long before there were any master plan developments in this valley. So as things evolved, the different municipalities changed their way of doing business. And that case was decided in 1977. But that case said, and if you look at it, it's clear, especially if you look at Justice Gunderson's dissent. What they said, what the Supreme Court, you all said back then, was essentially, you cannot sue for inverse condemnation for property you don't own. The Slope said, hey, we had a prescriptive easement here into our property. And the state came along and condemned the property. Well, the Slopes never actually had an easement. They didn't own that property and they never established the prescriptive easement. It was an easement by hope, not by necessity or prescription or any other legal method. They hoped they had an easement, they thought they had an easement. And when it went away, they sued for that easement. That's not what we have here. We have never sued for an easement on other people's property that we didn't own. My clients are saying, our property is now being deprived of all beneficial economic use. And unless you put a heliport onto it, there's not even any way to get there. Period. And that's undisputed. So what we have here is a situation where the city, which has ordinances, 19.95 and 19....
But aren't you really claiming the easement, in essence? You're saying that the devaluation in your property is that you do not have an ability to gain access to it. You would have to gain access to it over somebody else's land. Or public right-of-way.
Well, in a sense, we're saying that, Justice, I can't deny it. What we're essentially saying is the city takes on an obligation. The city has done this in every other instance. And
I would like to talk about the precedent that I think that City of Henderson is essentially trying to set here if this is allowed. But what we're saying is, yes, we needed and we expected that we would have access. And it's not as
if
in some shape or form or shape, somehow, the city ordinances say for a subdivider of lots, the city requires that there be access to every lot. Well, the city didn't require that in this case. So they're saying essentially everything, excuse me, by saying, well, this isn't a subdivision, so we didn't have to do anything. So we then reasonably rely upon the way every other landowner is treated to, when they do the planning, they come in and they say, where are we going to put the streets? And think about the precedent they would be setting. I would like to reserve a little bit of time here, but if this is allowed, then every outlier that buys property outside of the infrastructure in the county, a metropolitan area, the county, city of Henderson, Las Vegas, North Las Vegas, the city could essentially say, well, we're just going to bypass that property. We won't provide any roads to it. And we can acquire that property by eminent domain without ever actually having to pay for it. And, by the way, the beauty of this one is we get a free park, but the landowner still owns the land, so they can keep paying the taxes.
Could you elucidate for me why your client didn't raise this at the time the D.R. Horton maps were being approved? Or what is the road that goes by?
Canyon Heights Drive.
Yeah.
Actually, here's the problem. Because the city of Henderson has the planning staff that has the expertise to know where these roads should go and how they should go in. So, and this is the irony of the city's position. It said, hey, we didn't have the obligation to do this, and you should have known this at the time you bought the property. But here's the irony about that. My client went in for a zone change in 2005, and the city planning staff approved it. And you know how they approved it? Because they said there was access through the roadway at Canyon Heights Drive. But it turns out that, in fact, that was impractical. That couldn't have been done. So the city itself thought there was access to this property through a roadway that they had. If you look at the...
And so too did your client.
And so did my client. So my client felt they had... that was reinforced when the city approved the planning map initially. Then we got into a dispute about density. We went back, we lowered the density to 4 acres, and the city... A year and a half later, approved it again. And when I say the city, the planning staff, who is responsible for setting up and making sure these roadways connect to all property. So it's very disingenuous for the city to say, we knew this was never going to be have access, we didn't have an easement in the first place. Nobody had an easement. D.O. Horton didn't have an easement. So how did D.O. Horton get a road? It was just they were treated differently. That's our problem, Your Honor. And with the rich history that this state has in protecting landowners' rights, it is inconceivable to me that the city could stand here with a straight face and say, well, we didn't know it, they didn't know it, we've always done it before in every other instance. But now we don't have to. It just turned out that we made some mistakes. Those were our mistakes. The mistakes they made is by granting that conservation easement, we cannot undo that mistake now for tax reasons. So now this property is truly landlocked.
Mr. Jones, I might exclude it.
Yes.
First of all, to better understand this, looking at the curve, you're saying that even though your client's northeast corner butts Canyon Heights Drive, the access from the northeast corner is
in fact, Your Honor, we went beyond that. The answer to that is yes. My client, at great expense, went out and had a bunch of engineering done to determine if there was any way to access that property and go to D.R. Horton and say, well, maybe if we bring the road in further to the south on the east side, which is the only side that's not blocked by this conservation easement, can we get in there? And the answer is we determined that it is undisputed that you cannot do that because that's the steep side. This is essentially going down into a wash. So it's all the property on the west side of this 5 or 10 acres that is developable. And to compound it, Henderson has a 15-degree slope easement that restricts your ability to build on slope. So we went through all those machinations to determine whether or not you could access it by some other way.
And unfortunately, we found out there were not.
Even though this is a totally viable question, we're suggesting that the record is adequately developed to demonstrate as a matter of law that this property is identified.
Now, in fact, I believe, as far as I can tell, with the limited record we have, that's even disputed. In fact, I believe Ms. Savage, when she was addressing the audience, said it was landlocked. Then, meaning when my client bought it, and it's landlocked now. It wasn't landlocked. There was no conservation easement. Well, again, I would say it this way. There was no more landlocked than the D.R. Horton property that now had this Canyon Heights drive on it. That property had no easements.
At the time your client acquired the property, deed restrictions.
There were no deed restrictions. There were nothing of that nature.
Is it the case under the Battle of that it is illegal to block landlocked property?
Your Honor, that's, I believe, that what you're referring to, at least in my knowledge of the law, would essentially give rise to a prescriptive easement. Because you have potentially landlocked somebody's law, then at the land, you would then have some legal right to acquire it otherwise.
I didn't see in the briefs that argument. As a case for a penalty. The reference I'm making is if property is truly landlocked, the landowner can seek relief, if my memory is correct about our jurisprudence, for access to that property.
And here's the dilemma my
client
faced.
Is that true, and has that been articulated?
No, and here's the reason why. It's an impossibility now. We actually did, and I don't want to bring up several negotiations, but since you asked the question, we had some discussion.
I don't do that.
All right. Well, so the answer is no. Because of the conservation easement, there is the only practical access is through the property. My client was willing to give up a piece of property in exchange for the conservation easement. It couldn't be undone. That's when we explored the other option. Actually, we explored the other option.
The question I'm asking is this. In a truly landlocked parcel of property in which the property that surrounds the land parcel is government, where the government refuses to provide access, is that a basis for inverse condemnation?
That's essentially.
If so, is that a decentralized relation or is that some other relation?
I believe that you have actually hit the nail on the head from our perspective. We believe it is an inverse condemnation circumstance. Penn Central applies, and if you apply Penn Central, which is what used and referred to in Sisolak, then it is certainly not appropriate to have a decision made on 12b-5 basis. You need to have some discovery to determine whether or not they're truly landlocked in the circumstances of how they became landlocked. It was not landlocked until the conservation easement was agreed to years after my client bought it, without knowledge or notice to my client that that was being done. So my client had no opportunity to become involved in that process and only found out years later after we started this zoning issue. So, I would essentially say we should, I would ask the court to look at Cully versus County of Elko, which is an airport case. It came out in 85, where in that case, property that was not owned by the landowner was taken over by the airport, the county airport in Elko, and it destroyed their access. And the court, after a trial, granted a 41B motion to allow the landowner the right to argue that they had lost 50% of the value of the property. So that is a much more analogous case to this case than is Slope, which happened almost 10 years after Slope, where access was condemned. The landowner did not own the road itself, but the court found that impairing the access did harm the property, the burden property, and essentially said there was a claim there. So we just think it would be a horrible precedent to set for the state of Nevada to allow a city to essentially do this. If this is done, there's nothing to stop the city in the future but from doing it intentionally, even though we think it happened here in the first. Thank you for the extra time.
Good morning, Justice. This is Nancy Savage for the City of Kensington. We've heard a lot about the allegations. Well, let me back up. Since this is your motion for summary judgment, the only facts this court should consider are those set forth in the motion. Mr. Jones has raised additional facts.
It's here on the motion to dismiss, correct?
Correct, it is.
You misspoke. You said summary judgment.
That's another case. That's correct. So the motion for summary judgment, the only thing that we got are factual allegations. There's some preliminary allegations to be given to the plaintiff, and those aren't supposed to be considered more of the inferences. During the course of arguments on this, from the time of the arguments on the motion for summary judgment, through briefing here and now again today, more and more facts not contained in the complaint agreement, or I should say, alleged facts are being brought forth, and those should not be considered when determining whether the district court judge appropriately granted the motion to dismiss.
But we have an extremely deferential standard of review on appeals from around motions to dismiss, which is troubling here, given his arguments are not outside the pale of the fair averments of the complaint, are they? And if they are, tell me which ones.
Well, you know, I think that obviously there is some relevancy. I would note that not if there were additional facts to support the claims, the appropriate action in lower court would have been to move to amend the complaint to add additional allegations. I think that as alleged in the complaint, and I think it does set forth, you know, fairly specifically the timeline and what occurred when in respect to this property, I think that it's insufficient to state it claim in this time. First of all, there's been a lot of argument about whether there was access, whether there should have been access, and first of all, I mean, it's admitted in these facts that when the property was purchased, there was no access to the property. There was no access to the property at the point in time that the open space deed was signed. And if you don't have a property right, that's the fundamental element of any claim for inter-reverse condemnation. You can't seek recovery for a taking of property that you didn't have. You have to have a property.
Isn't the policy of the city of Henderson to permit landlocked property within city boundaries?
I think, basically, this property was purchased during a time of rapid expansion in the city of Henderson.
Well, I appreciate all that. What is the city of Henderson's policy since this case has come out, or involving this case?
Well, the city of Henderson...
You permit landlocked property as a matter of use of planning. That would be a big surprise to me, given what I've seen other cities do.
And I believe in the planning process that the effort is made not to have landlocked property. And by landlocked, just so we're clear, I'm talking about property that the surrounding property is owned by others.
Do you stipulate that the property in this case is land?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's surrounded on all sides by property owned by others. At all points in time.
Right. So is it the policy of the city of Henderson to permit landlocked property as part of its land use planning processes?
I would be misstating if I said that I had, that I knew that specifically was not a policy or was a policy.
Is that a matter that could have been developed in discovery if this were not actually a prior motion?
Well, that would certainly be a matter that could be developed.
And if it were developed that such a policy, the city of Henderson does not permit landlocked property as part of its land use planning, wouldn't that be a fact that the court should take into consideration in an inverse condemnation?
I don't think that unless there's an ordinance to be that, that it's a regulatory taking situation. It's, I mean, what's being alleged here is not formal policy, but they've alleged as far as their allegations are, you know, it was our expectation. We think that the city was doing this and this.
Well, the argument of the plaintiff, as I understand it, is that the city's policy would be against committing landlocked property. That the city entertained the streets when the airport developed its property to the south. And that the city, instead of providing for alternative access to this property, because it had been mistakenly designated on this map as the public, did not protect the property for access. Finally, if they entered into a deed restriction that effectively ensured its landlocked position. So that's what it sounds like. I don't know if they include me in this, but that's their theory. Why shouldn't the district court allow them to formulate the theory?
Well, because I think that the municipal code sections that they relied upon, first of all, don't say what they're saying. I mean, it places the burden upon the subdivider to provide access. And this is a situation where this is a very small parcel of land, obviously, was subdivided at some point on the land. Their action actually should be against whoever the subdivider was on that, bears responsibility under the code for ensuring that there was access. Now, certainly, you know, the city isn't responsible for doing due diligence on every parcel that is transferred between parties, whether by purchase or otherwise, and it certainly isn't the city's responsibility. And I don't believe that the plaintiff has provided any authority to the extent that it's the city's responsibility bear the burden of providing access to any property, any piece of property, or to bear the risk of the purchase of any piece of property within the jurisdiction of the city of Henderson. Basically, as far as the inverse condemnation action, and getting back to this, is that there had to have been a property right in existence, and no property right has been shown.
Which gets to my earlier. I believe that Nevada law corners landlocked property and allows for the landlocked landowner to secure or receive access to the property from adjacent landowners. In this case, the argument is that's been prohibited with the deed restriction.
Well,
you share that view of that?
No, because the deed restriction only was on one portion of the property. And I think we did brief this somewhat in one brief because
it's
slow pace.
My characterization of your experience, though, that Nevada holds a landlocked parcel that affords the landowner an opportunity to seek access.
It does, and this landowner did not seek access. It did not seek a prescriptive easement. It did not seek an easement by necessity. Had it taken that action prior to this, and this started, I mean, the purchase was 5 years before the open space deed restriction occurred. Had that occurred, they would have had a property right at the point in time where the deed restriction went forward. Now, the deed restriction itself, I don't believe there's any authority stating that by accepting the deed restriction, that constituted a regulation for purposes of a regulatory taking. And council has referred to the Sisolak case as probably primarily the case that's been applied here. In Sisolak, there were two specific county ordinances that were enacted after purchase of the property, which caused restrictions to the property. Here we're not talking about any enactment of codes, no enactment of regulations. In the Lucas case, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case frequently cited, there was a state legislative act that was involved after the property had been purchased. And so I think it's a far stretch in this situation to say that there's been a regulatory taking.
Well, let's explore that a moment. My understanding was that the city was asked to rezone this property. It didn't accept the application level sought by the applicant. It did approve the rezoning at a different level, is that right?
That's correct.
How did the city do that if one of the conditions under Chapter 278 of NRS is that access is demonstrated, be demonstrated as a condition to approve it?
I believe that is part of the feasibility analysis. There was
there's a state law that requires that one demonstrate access to the property.
Correct. The plaintiff would have provided that information to the city. I believe that the problem was what's the cost of that access to the plaintiff. And that is where their decision came into play. How much do you want to pay to be able to access it from, you know, either the northwest corner, originally it was the northeast corner, where they're now saying, oh, well, the slope was too great. As indicated, they had engineers come in and basically told the city, yeah, we could get access at that
point. What I'm trying to understand
was
the approval of property project as city approval based upon access to the northeast, to the northwest, or did the city even know where the access was coming from?
My understanding is, my recollection, Justice, is that, I'm trying not to confuse northeast and northwest as I'm sitting here, it was that there was a point of access, I believe it was northeast at that point. One of the problems with respect to the approved, yes.
To the canyon.
Yes. And one of the problems was, as far as approval for greater density, was that the appropriate site maps were not submitted by the plaintiff in this case.
But on the access issue, it's really not based on
that. That's my recollection.
Does the record show this, or are we asking you to rely on your own?
I believe that it's in the record, that it's in a footnote. In our briefings, I don't know if it's in our original. I think it's probably in our reply.
Thank you.
And so just to wrap it up, I think that's funny. Is that the plaintiffs have alleged a dangerous precedent should the motion to dismiss be granted here. I would caution that there's an even more dangerous precedent should you accept what the plaintiff's argument has been here. And that is basically that in all situations that somehow the city has the responsibility to go into each and every parcel, ensure that there's access, ensure and guarantee basically that the purchase that's been made, regardless of what the plaintiff's action is. If you read the plaintiff's briefings in this matter, basically what the plaintiff has said in the complaint as well is we purchased this property and sat back and just waited for access and utilities to come to us. We expected that to happen, basically, at no cost. Currently, you know, if the court accepts that argument, what is the ramification for local government throughout the states and the courts as well? I mean, this is going to open the floodgate of everybody who's not happy of the land they got stuck with somewhere before the real estate bubble burst, and the burden on municipalities and other local government would be astronomical.
Well, what would have been the course of action, in your estimation, that this landowner should have pursued? They should have objected at the time of the deed conveying the property and placing the restrictions on its use. Is that your point? They had some remedy there?
Exactly. They did have a prior remedy that they could have objected at that point. and from that basis, they actually would have been able to take a judicial review from the decision if they made the objection. And I think that that's the point. If their problem was with the open space, that they should have made their objection. Now, otherwise, they should have sought to obtain an easement, either prescriptive or by necessity, or they should have negotiated with the adjacent landowner, T.R. Horton, or one of the other landowners, to obtain access.
Well, D.R. Horton, before the open space was created, D.R. Horton owned the land on all sides of this property. Is that right or not?
I do not believe that's correct, but yeah, my recollection on that, my knowledge on that is not terribly good.
Mr. Jones has referred the panel, as he's reached it, to the Cully versus County of Cullies. I wonder what your view is about the application of this case, of that case, excuse me, in this one.
I don't believe that that case, trying to remember that case as opposed to the other ones. I do recall that that one does have to do with the airplane. And I believe that it was a distinguishing factor as far as, because is that the one where they expanded the runways
right out?
Okay.
The argument that he makes is that it always sets the groundwork for a clean property for inverse condemnation that they can demonstrate interference with access to the landowner's
property. Well, I think it's distinguished on this point. There was access to the property in that case, and by extending the runway out, that interfered with the access that was in place. Here, there was no access and no right to access at the point in time where the open space deed was reported, accepted, and reported. Thank you.
Mr. Jones, give you a couple minutes. 2 minutes. Thank you very much. My first observation is that the Savage probably succumbed to the same temptation I did. You talked a lot about facts and different facts and what happened. And that's the problem. Where did the 12B5 motion? We didn't get the opportunity to explore those facts at all. And I would point out to the court on page, the Joint Appendix 5, page 5 of 6 of our complaint, we say in paragraph 24, it was not until Land W petitioned for judicial review of the city's decision. That petition was denied. Land W appealed. Settlement toxins ensued that Land W discovered the conservation restriction and equitable servitude on the open space land and topographical conditions of the property absolutely precluded Land W from ever developing the property. So if you take Ms. Savage's argument at face value, the city now owns the land that is the only way to access the property of my client. She would then have the court believe that my client should have known about a negotiation between a third party and the city that my client has had no reason to be a part of or ever be aware of until ultimately they went in to try to get their property zoned and got slapped in the face with it. So essentially the city is telling this court, look, we can go out and we can negotiate with another third party to absolutely categorically landlock a property owner's property in the future. They don't ever know about it, but if we do that, if they didn't already have an easement to their property, they're out of luck. So I think that is a bizarre interpretation of our law, especially in the context of Sisolak and State versus Las Vegas Painting. There's a quote from State versus Las Vegas Painting that I think is really sums up what I believe to be the appropriate approach by our court. And the court said, the paramount purpose of eminent domain law is to do substantial justice and thus concerns itself with fairness and public policy. And I would leave the courts with this. If, in fact, this precedent is allowed, this becomes precedent,
remember, this was a mistake. We do not believe, and we have not asserted that the city did this on purpose, but it is clear there were mistakes made by the city. The mapping, conservation easement that cannot be turned around, that was the only point of access. The city was, just like she said, actually, the city has always done this. So this is the only case that we're allowed to develop the facts, as I believe we have a right to under Nevada law. I believe we will readily prove the city's never done this before, consistent with your point, Justice Hardesty, under Chapter 278. They would never do this. They're the experts on this. They're the ones that know the big picture. They have the whole, the 40,000-foot level viewpoint on this and what property is owned by whom and how to get there and get away from it. So we would ask you not to allow this to go forward this way, or other landowners in the future will be the subject of this intentionally, where the city decides it wants to acquire a nice chunk of property, so we'll just make sure there's never a road going to.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris.
Thank you.
Inspiring arguments and briefs in this matter. I'm going to create this matter of advice. Case is submitted.